Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The U.S. State Department is in charge of the refugee program, from how many the country will take in, to who can come, to where they'll be placed. And for a small state, New Hampshire has seen a fair amount of resettlement. In 2016, for example, more than 500 refugees were placed here, most from three countries, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Bhutan, and Myanmar. Under the Trump White House, those numbers have dropped dramatically to 162 refugees in New Hampshire last year. And so today in The Exchange, we take another look at refugee resettlement, with a focus this time on Manchester. So let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We begin with Jeff Thielman. He's president and CEO of the International Institute of New England, which resettles refugees in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And a little bit later, we'll hear from two refugees from Manchester, as well as an educator in the Queen City's school system. For now, though, Jeff, welcome back. Really nice to see you.
Great to see you, too.
So what makes a person, Jeff, a refugee?
So a refugee is someone who is forced to flee his or her country of origin because of persecution, war, or violence. It's someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution, cannot return to their homeland because of their nationality, their political opinion, their membership in a religious organization, or because of their faith, or someone who is part of a particular social group. And there are now 25.4 million refugees in the world. We're going to get new numbers from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees later this month. There's about 68 million displaced people. 40 million people are displaced within their countries, but there's 25.4 million refugees. That means they've left their homelands, they can't go home again, and they're trying to get resettled someplace, somewhere in the world.
Now, in this country, we've heard, Jeff, a lot about asylum seekers. So what's the difference?
So an asylum seeker is someone who is in the country on a visa, or they've been paroled, they've come to the border, they said they've got an asylum claim, they've been admitted into the country, they're either in a detention facility or they've been released, and so they've come into the United States and they're seeking asylum. Same definition, they have a well-founded fear of persecution back in their native country. A refugee is someone who has not yet come to the United States and is going through an intense processing process outside of the United States. So they're going through security checks, they're meeting with State Department officials, they're going through Homeland Security people, rather, are interviewing them. They're going through between 18 and 24 months of security checks before they are admitted to the United States.
So it's just a matter, partly, Jeff, of where someone is located?
Correct. Yeah, correct.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so...
And oftentimes, so for example, lots of visa, lots of asylum seekers are people who come here on a student visa, a tourist visa, and then, of course, we have the whole crisis now on the southern border. And then a refugee, though, is someone who leaves Syria, for example, goes to Turkey, applies to United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Office for refugee status, and then applies for resettlement somewhere in the world. Resettlement meaning it's a path to security and citizenship in another country.
So there's been a lot of press, as you know, Jeff, recently on the dramatically lower numbers of refugees that the Trump administration is going to allow. The administration says it's partly because there are so many seeking asylum on the Mexican border. So I want to play a little clip of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying, again, some will characterize, he said, the administration's refugee ceiling as the, quote, sole barometer of the American commitment to vulnerable people. But Pompeo said, look at the big picture. That's not the right way to look at it.
Other countries, when noting their humanitarian protection efforts, highlight their assistance to both refugees and asylees. The United States should do the same. This year's refugee ceiling reflects the substantial increase in the number of individuals seeking asylum in our country, leading to a massive backlog of outstanding asylum cases and greater public expense. The daunting operational reality of addressing the over 800,000 individuals in pending asylum cases demands renewed focus and prioritization. The magnitude of this challenge is unequaled in any other country.
So, Jeff, how do you feel about that? There's so many people seeking asylum now on our southern border, Mike Pompeo says, that we just can't keep the same numbers of people coming in through the refugee program. We're too busy managing this asylum problem.
Well, the refugee program has been around since 1980 in a formal way in this country. We started resettling refugees after World War II, and we recognized that we had not admitted people who were fleeing the Holocaust, Jews fleeing the Holocaust, since the United States did some soul searching and decided we need to admit refugees. So there were different acts of Congress passed in the 40s and the 50s that allowed certain people, like people from Hungary, displaced people from World War II, to come to the United States. Acts of Congress passed to allow people to come after the fall of the Vietnam, the end of the Vietnam War, and then the formal refugee resettlement program passed in 1980. The Refugee Resettlement Act of 1980 was adopted and supported by both parties through all sorts of different historical challenges that have happened over our history. We had the Cuban boat lift, and refugees kept coming into the country. We've had asylum seekers pressing on our borders for years because of conflict in Central America, and the United States continued the Refugee Resettlement Program. Why do we have a Refugee Resettlement Program? Well, you know, one, it's a humanitarian program. We signed the UN Convention, or we signed the protocol to the UN Convention on Refugees that said we'll be part of the solution to the refugee problem around the world. We'll help that. Two, our partners, our diplomat, we do this for diplomatic purposes. Our strategic partners around the world are taking refugees, and so the United States needs to do its part. And three, militarily, we have people that serve with the U.S. military in different parts of the world. And a part of their reward for helping us, for helping our troops, for transiting for our troops, is to be able to come to the United States. So it's interesting to hear Secretary Pompeo's quotes. But, you know, I go to the Washington, D.C. a couple times a year, and we're briefed by people in the State Department. And so we get some information as well, not as much information as the Secretary of State. But, you know, we're told every year that military leaders, diplomatic corps members are pressing the United States government, their government, our government, to take more refugees. So, yes, there's a need to address the asylum seekers on the southern border. Yes, there's a need for more people to be addressing this, the asylum issue, asylees inside the country, because there's a backlog of cases. But we still have an obligation, a moral obligation, and a need to address refugees who come in from around the world.
The numbers on the southern border are pretty staggering, Jeff. So just in terms of a resource issue, do we have enough people to process all this, to do it safely, to do it the right way? Do we have enough resources to expand the number of refugees back to where it was and deal with this crush of people at the southern border?
I don't know for certain if we have enough people. I suspect, I mean, I'm sure we don't. I'm sure we need to put more people on the southern border. But we have a shortage of labor in the United States of America, especially here in New Hampshire and especially in New England. And so these folks that are coming from the southern border as seeking asylum, and people who want to come to the United States as refugees, can help us here in New Hampshire and throughout New England address our labor shortage. We have an unemployment rate in the state of, I don't know, below 2.5%, something like that. You talk to any employer. You had your program last week.
2 weeks ago, we did a whole series on workforce shortages.
Well, there you
in
have
New Hampshire.
It. Yeah, and so we do not have enough workers. So yes, I think the United States government should put resources into addressing both the asylum problem and the refugee problem around the world, so that more people can come here and come to work here in this country.
So setting aside the politics then, Jeff, for a moment, just remind our listeners what your organization's role is in this process.
So we're at the end of the process. The way the program works is the 1980 Act gives the President of the United States the power to set the number of refugees who can come into the country every year. There's about 1.1 million legal immigrants who come into the United States. Refugees are a component of that number. President Obama set the number to about 85,000 people a year. We've admitted 3.1 million refugees since 1980. President Trump set the number at 45,000 for fiscal year 18. He set the number at 30,000 for fiscal year 19. So he sets the number. Then refugees go through a vetting process overseas after about 2 years of vetting.
Which is pretty extensive.
It's very extensive. I mean, there's 9 different security checks. I mean, they're the most vetted immigrants to the United States, period. And so once they come to the United States, they're approved for coming to the United States, then we get involved. So our staff on the ground in Manchester finds apartments for people. We receive them at the airport. We place them in their apartment. We enroll them in healthcare program. We take them to their initial medical appointments. We help them to find a job. We teach them English. We have a cultural orientation program. And we enroll their kids in public schools in Manchester. And so we're working with community partners to get folks integrated. They integrate fairly quickly. They move. They're excited to come to the United States. They've suffered a great deal. They've gone through a lot to get here. And when they get here, they're ready to contribute and come to work.
At what point is a refugee on his or her own?
Well, I mean, in a sense, they're on their own when they get here. They're adults and they've got to try. But, you know, they've got our support for up to 5 years, and they've got a certain amount of support from us that includes. So they're getting some cash assistance. They're getting some financial assistance, not a lot. But right away, what we're really focused on at the International Institute is teaching them English and helping them to find a job as quickly as possible.
Well, and in a few minutes, we'll bring in our refugees and someone who works in Manchester on English language learning. But just real quickly, Jeff, two more just points of information for listeners. First of all, to clarify, you guys work in Manchester and Nashua. Somebody else does Concord.
That's correct. Accenture Care Alliance does Concord. They do a great job.
And from what countries are most refugees in New Hampshire coming from?
Well, these days we get a lot from the Democratic Republic of Congo. We get Rohingyan refugees We've gotten Burmese refugees. We've gotten people. Last year we got a group from Somalia. Years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago, when President Obama was trying to get 10,000 to 12,500 or so refugees from Syria, we resettled families from Syria here in Manchester or in the Manchester area. And so, but you know, lots of people now from the Congo.
Well, and Rohingya, by the way, is from Myanmar?
Myanmar, that's correct.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, I want to bring our other guests in. We're joined in studio also by Amu Deng. She's originally from South Sudan. She's been here for 15 years. Amu has a family. She works for Easter Seals, helping elderly people and refugees. And Amu, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Nice to meet you, too.
Also with us, Jackson Efuta. He arrived in Manchester just last fall from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He found work as a truck loader. He's 27 years old. And Jackson, you just got here last fall. Here you are on the radio. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
It was nice to meet you.
And also with us, Wendy Perrin, Director of English Learner Instruction Services for the Manchester Schools. And Wendy, nice to meet you, too. Thank you for your time.
Good to be here.
Well, Amu, I want to start with you. Many listeners may remember hearing about war in Sudan, but just remind us, if you could, Amu, what happened there that made it so dangerous that you had to leave?
To leave my country, I left because of safeties, and there's not a lot of work or to get education. So a lot of people, they don't have a good background of education, including myself. That the main reason, and safeties, like it's not really safe by then. And I left my country with my firstborn and a husband from northern Sudan, where I grew up, to Egypt. I've been in Egypt for 2 years, apply for United Nations to be transferred to anywhere to be safe and seek for education and help family back. I came to United States in the state of New Hampshire in Manchester about 15 years ago. And with my 2 kids, I got a second child born in Egypt. So we arrived in Manchester on August 12, 2004.
So almost 15 years.
Yes. And it was not easy to be here, but so far, so good. I got a lot of help. My husband got a job and 3 months later, and we studied English. It was not easy for me, especially. I don't like to get out from the house because I have no idea how to communicate with people.
Oh, yeah. Extremely intimidating to not speak the language and try to get out and about. And in another minute, I want to ask your first impressions of New Hampshire. But Amu, so there was a civil war in Sudan, right, which ended up with the country being split between two countries.
Yes. And it was really, it's so far as like, by then I was very young, so I don't know, I have no idea how this started, because by that time, South Sudan, when they start to be, to begin to complain to get their right, that May I born in 3 months later, it was on May 16, and I born in August. And also because of that, I don't even have a birth certificate. So I go with January 1st, but it's not my real birthday. But I have to go with that because there's nowhere to get that, even though I'm the youngest one in the family. So my oldest brothers, they know when I was born and what day, what month. But because there's no evidence, I don't have that. It was a part of war.
Yeah, and that sometimes makes things difficult not to have that birth certificate. Every time you turn around when you're a new arrival, people want to see it. Jackson, as I said, you just got here. And just please remind our listeners what was going on in the Democratic Republic of the Congo that you had to leave.
Yeah, most especially we fled from Congo. It has been like in 2003. That's when we flew from Congo, going to Uganda, where it's UNHCR research laws for refugees. It's like a union. It's a United Nations High Commission for Refugees. But most especially, we flew from Congo because of tribe discrimination, which was like through people fighting through, like tribe. Like if your tribe's not the same like mine, you find fighting between themselves. Then we came to Uganda, we will find UNHCR, welcomed us, they had to resettle. I went to Uganda in 2003, then I had to start my school there. Actually, it wasn't good because lack of education is so low. But time and time, I had to join another school where I got scholarship because of like I was determined, like someone who is clever, like being wise. So they had to give me a scholarship. Yeah. The Jackson, you afford this. You can go at the high school and get better education. Then later in 2013, that's when I started my interview coming to the United States.
In 2013?
Yes.
So that's what? 5 or 6 years ago. So mm-hmm. It took 5 or 6 years for you to get fully vetted.
Really? Yeah. It takes long, like, to get approved by the government of the United States. You first do the interviews. They take you through medical checks, whatever, which is pretty good. Yeah. So when I got here last fall, it was in October. Yeah. The weather was so cold. Yeah.
And it got even colder, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you?
Like, I was, what am I going? Am I going to survive in this cold, really? But, like, the Institute, the International Institute of New England, help people, refugees coming here, giving them their winter clothes, coats, boots, gloves, hat. We feel like we're good.
Wow. In a few minutes, I've got a lot more questions for you, Anamu. And Wendy, I'll bring you in too in a few minutes. Again, working with English language learners in the Manchester schools. And we'll start taking your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, today on The Exchange, we're revisiting the topic of refugee resettlement, given the changes that we heard about at the federal level. And for today, we're focusing on one city's experience, the Queen City of Manchester. Again, we'd love to hear from you if you have questions or comments about how the refugee program works, what it's all about. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, or 1-800-892-6477.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
Support NHPR today for a chance to win two $1,000 Southwest Airline gift cards. Good for flying out to visit friends in San Jose, California, or exploring rainforests near San Jose, Costa Rica. You'll be automatically entered into this incredible drawing to choose your own adventure when you support NHPR today at nhpr.org. Good luck.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, refugee resettlement in Manchester. We're looking at recent changes in this federal program from the State Department and talking with refugees themselves about their experiences living in the Queen City. And let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Jeff Thielman, President and CEO of the International Institute of New England, which resettles refugees in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Also with us, Amu Deng. She's originally from South Sudan. She's been here for 15 years, as she told us. Today, she has a family. She works for Easter Seals, helping the elderly and other refugees. And Jackson Ifuta is with us. He arrived in Manchester just last fall from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he is working right now as a truck loader. He's 27 years old. Also with us is Wendy Perrin, Director of English Learner Instruction for the Manchester Schools. And Wendy, let's fold you into this. First of all, just describe for us who you're working with in Manchester and roughly how many people.
Sure. So my job is to support the 2,200 English learners we have in the school district. And an English learner is the term we use to describe students who are both refugees and immigrants that settle in the U.S. from other countries and whose first language is not English. And those students represent about 60 languages in 75 countries.
60 languages?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And, you know, the focus of my work is to really ensure quality instruction for those students in our 22 schools. So we do have programs to support our English learners in all 22 schools. And according to federal law, states really have to have a plan for doing that on record so that we can eliminate any potential language barriers and make sure that students who come to us are accessing grade level appropriate content right away.
Do you work with adults as well, or is that another program?
That's another program.
Yeah.
So we service students K through 12.
Just give us a sense of the, you said 60 languages. Obviously, I'm not going to ask you to list all 60, but what kind of languages are we talking about? That's really interesting.
And, you know, I get that question a lot. So we keep that data right on our website. But and currently, the most spoken language in the school district is Spanish, followed by Arabic, Swahili, Nepali, French, Vietnamese, Mai, Bosnian, Somali, and Portuguese. Those are the top 10 most frequently spoken languages.
And just personally, Wendy, what have you learned working with refugee students, since that's our focus today?
I tell people all the time it's a great honor to serve these families. And to answer that question would be so difficult in just a minute. But I learned so much about global politics, world religion, about resilience in families. I've learned so much about hard work. So it's just an honor to really work with families and help our students bring those assets they have from their home countries and from their primary languages into the classroom and let that really enrich our classroom. So every year it's something new and again, honored to do the work.
Well, and it's kind of unfair, but kids pick up languages so much more quickly than adults. I wonder what sort of dynamics you see working out in families as the kids pick it up pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, that's something we talk a lot with families about. When we have parent-teacher conferences, we talk about the academics. How are they doing academically? We talk about the language. How are they developing their English proficiency? And then we talk, how are they managing life with a foot in two cultures? And when that power shifts and students begin to learn more language than their parents, we try to really put safeguards in place to make sure interpreters are there so parents fully understand what's happening in schools. And we actually have a team of bilingual family liaisons that are really cultural brokers. So they work in the schools with families, and they also may do home visits to really make sure our families understand what's happening in schools so that that power shift doesn't affect the personal relationships inside the homes.
Power shift meaning the child has some extra power because he or she now speaks English very well and mom or dad may not.
Right, and they may understand some of the cultural systems, particularly in schools, more than parents. So they, you know, might leave school early and not tell their parents, or they might not understand the academic side of the system, and so they may not always be honest with their parents about how they're doing. So there's power within the culture and the language that I think we work really hard to engage parents and make sure that they understand the system and offer them language assistance so that they're always part of the conversation.
Okay, and Amu is nodding, so I want to ask you about that. Amu, very quickly, your children, you have several children. How easy has it been for them to learn English?
You know, so far on my firstborn, he was the one actually suffered from being a new child to the different country where he has no idea where to start or where to begin. And he doesn't used to go to daycare or free school. He was home until when he started kindergarten. And he did it on his own with all the school support when he got in there. And he's the best. He's learning, he's teaching the rest of them. Like, I call him, you are the role model for the house, because his siblings are picking up after him. He's like, he pick it up quickly. He start to spell his own name by himself when he's studying kindergarten, which is like, it's very hard to start a school without knowing how, what the first letter your name is start with. But I thank him a lot because his name is Kwani. Right now he's on 12th grade.
He's going to graduate high school soon.
He should this year, but he's one of those kids. He play basketball and he say play soccer. So he's looking for a scholarship. So he got to new school last 2 years, and the school offered him, hey, do you want to move forward or do you want to stay back? You have a chance. If you stay back, you may win the scholarship on basketball. So he say, I will stay back, even though my grade I look great. I'm gonna stay back to see, to look for that. So he's gonna graduate next year. But on my kids, they don't sneak out from school. I try my best to know what they're doing, even though I don't understand English very well. But I am on the top of that. I have to know school. I call the school. I receive a phone call from school. I call back. Why did you call? I want to know what they're doing. So. But a lot of kids, yes, and even though sometimes I encourage one in my community, some people, you have to know what is your child doing. Don't just, because in back then, the kids, like in my country, they more eligible to manage themselves, but here it's very less. So it's like you need to give them that support. You need to be there for them. You need to know what they're doing. Don't just lay back and assume they are doing great. Sometimes it's not.
Because even if they tell you they are,
yes.
Yeah, they may not be that power dynamic that,
yes,
that Wendy talked about. I want to bring our listeners into our conversation, and then I have so many more questions for all of you. Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Greg is calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Greg. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
hello, Jeff. We've spoken. I'm a retired Foreign Service officer who served as the refugee coordinator for West Africa from 2003 to 2005 in the aftermath of the Liberian Civil War, the Second Liberian Civil War. And I was part of a team that resettled over 8,000 Liberians to the United States. I want to reiterate one of the points that Jeff made, and that is that basically asylum and refugee resettlement are, in essence, the same thing. They're both interviewed by U.S. asylum officers. And to get right to my point, I think that we and the Trump administration should be increasing our refugee numbers from where they are now, about 30,000 a year, to more like 100,000 a year, and that we should be more proactive in our efforts to identify the really deserving refugees that are out there. As Jeff mentioned, there's over 25 million. Even if we had 25,000 people down on our southern border waiting for asylum interviews, we've got 1,000 times more than that elsewhere in the world. And among them, there are a lot of deserving people like Amu and Jackson. So that's my point today. Thanks.
Well, Greg, thank you for the call, and it's good to hear from you, given your experience in this issue. So thank you very much for being with us. And let's go next to Ron, who's calling in. Hi, Ron. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. This is Ron Abramson from Immigration Solutions in Manchester.
Okay. Good morning, Ron.
Hi. So after 21 years of practicing immigration law and specifically handling a number of cases involving asylum and then helping refugees in various capacities. I want to encourage the listeners to take the public information we're being fed with a grain of salt. And there are a lot of issues happening at the border that include metering and basically a decision as to how to prioritize or allocate resources that are, if not manufacturing a crisis, certainly exacerbating the situation and manipulating the public perception of it.
What does metering mean, Ron?
Metering means that by shutting down and slowing down the process, it creates a further backlog. So there is a legal way to present oneself at a port of entry and ask for asylum. That is an absolutely guaranteed right under both domestic and international law. This administration has chosen to, let's just say, severely curtail that ability in a logistical and practical way. And therefore, we're seeing this quote-unquote crisis when, in terms of a historical comparison, the numbers are not out of sync from what we have seen in the past.
So that's it's a manufactured crisis. Ron, thank you very much for the call. So, Jeff, this is more of a policy question. I don't know if you want to jump in on what Ron said.
Well, I think he's right. I mean, I think he's right that this is a manufactured crisis. We have faced this kind of pressure on the southern border and on our borders in the past. And at the same time, we have admitted refugees. So and Greg is right, too. We should be admitting about 100,000 refugees a year, at least in this country. We're big enough. We have enough need for workers right now. And we have a longstanding history of resettling refugees. And the facts on the ground show that when the United States of America resettles refugees, people in other countries are kinder to refugees, and it alleviates some of the pressure on the system worldwide.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo again. Here he is saying that the administration's focus is to assist refugees and other displaced people as close to their home countries as possible. He says that's the focus. Let's hear.
The United States is steadfast in prioritizing a course of action that enables the safe and voluntary return of refugees to their home countries, if and when conditions permit, a solution that most refugees prefer. This strategy reflects our deep commitment to achieving optimal humanitarian outcomes. The best way to help most people is to promote burden sharing with partners and allies, to work to end conflicts that drive displacement in the first place, and to target the application of foreign aid in a smarter way.
Again, that's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. So, Jeff, is that what most refugees prefer, to stay closer to the home country so that they can return if things settle down?
I think a lot of the refugees that I've met from Syria would love to go back to Syria of 2010 to 2009. That's not going to happen. It's not realistic. What Secretary Pompeo is saying is unrealistic. You're not going to have a peaceful Syria. You're not going to have people going back to Syria. And Turkey and Egypt and other countries that are taking refugees from Syria, for example, don't give them equal rights. They're not able to earn the same hourly wage. They're not able to really resettle there, put their kids in schools in some cases. So what he's talking about is just not realistic. I think the better message from the administration would be to admit more refugees. And by admitting more refugees, it puts pressure on countries around the world to do what the United States of America is doing.
So, Amu, you've been here 15 years. You have children. You're settled. You have a job. Your kids are in school. You just told us about your older boy. He's really doing well. Is going back even a possibility that you entertain sometimes?
You know, my hope for me, I would love to go back if it's safe. There's no problem. There's no better place to where you grow up or where your family is. Being in the United States is the best safety place. It gives you a lot of opportunity, but it doesn't give you your family. So if your country is safe, why not going back? But the main reason, according to my feeling or my team, when it's not safe, how are you going to go back?
And it's still not safe. We heard news about Sudan and South Sudan just this morning.
Yes.
Your kids are probably feeling very American at this point, your younger kids. So that would be, tricky.
I have two kids born in the United States. I have my third child. His name Kerr. He born in Elliott Hospital in Manchester. And I have Alem. She's born in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And Hitchcock, I think Hitchcock yeah. Hospital. Yeah, for it was my health condition, it was not safe to be like, so they sent me up there. And but at the end of it, everything went safely. They have no idea about my country. They just listening to me and my husband talk to them. They ask a lot of questions, why we don't have a grandparent here. And further, they want to know more. But they're also American. They have an idea in America more than they were originally from because they born here. So they don't consider some place. They love to go see other places like any American, but they have no idea what is that to be there.
It's really interesting.
And it's my hope one day to take them there to see where I grow up, even though they're not going to see where I grow up, but they will see part of it. So if soon is safe, I believe all the refugees, they did not come here just to disconnect where they belong to. It's just for safety and seek for more education. If they safe back then, they will go back. But if it's not safe, there's nowhere to go.
Mm. How about you, Jackson? You just got here. I almost feel bad throwing this question at you, but I will. We just heard from Mike Pompeo say most refugees would prefer to stay close to their home country so that they could go back if it was safe. How do you feel about that?
On my side, I feel like I can't go back, really, because like all my parents, they passed away. So
I'm sorry.
I have no way that I can go back. No one I'm going to find you. I'm going to find there. I only have one sister who is also in the process of coming here. And one sister got married in Canada. So we only just three childs in their house. So I have no any idea of going back. Though it would be peace, like the country is not settled, it's not good, I won't go back because I have no one that I'm going to find there. So I have to build my future here. I have to know who I am.
What do you think about that, Wendy?
Yeah, we hear these stories a lot from families, and I think it's the great struggle of the next generation. And I think many Americans have similar roots. I mean, my own grandparents resettled from Lebanon and the other side of my family from Canada. So I think there are a lot of immigration stories, and that's what makes the history of the United States so rich. But certainly we, as part of some of our curriculum work inside the classroom, we know how important it is to give students a space to kind of process this feeling, this idea of living between two cultures. And so I think it's therapeutic sometimes to write about that and reflect on that. And then to take those stories home and share them with their families can be a pretty powerful experience.
Given your work with refugee families and especially children, Wendy, what do they need the most?
We get such different groups of refugees. I think the needs change. When Syrian refugees were being resettled a couple of years ago, they were coming in with strong educational backgrounds, and we really wanted to make sure any language barriers didn't prohibit them from really advancing academically. So we count on community partnerships like those from one we have with St. Anselm's to offer some enrichment classes to students after school. While other students may need more support services during the summer if they've had gaps in their educational history.
Sure, if you're at a refugee camp.
Right. So we've had to really customize our curriculum and wrap around services to make sure we're meeting individual needs of those refugees.
So you almost can't answer that question because everyone's so different.
Exactly. Right.
All right. We'll talk a lot more after a short break. And you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More on refugee resettlement in the Queen City of Manchester today in The Exchange. More in a moment.
Ever been listening to NHPR's The Exchange when something interrupts?
What do other states allow? Do they say that that is okay?
That's interesting.
Hey, Linda, the TPS reports are due in 15 minutes. And we need to go over the quarterly numbers.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, I gotta be honest.
Check out The Exchange podcast feed and never miss another fascinating discussion again. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a New Hampshire look at the 2020 census. That's tomorrow in The Exchange, so join us for that live at 9. This hour, refugee resettlement with a focus on Manchester today. Send your email to exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With us in studio, Jackson Ifuta. He arrived in Manchester just last fall from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's found work as a truck loader. He's 27. Also with us, Amu Deng, originally from South Sudan. She's been here for 15 years. She's been telling us about her family and her work with Easter Seals, helping elderly people and refugees. Wendy Perrin is here, Director of English Learner Instruction Services for Manchester Schools, along with Jeff Thielman, President and CEO of the International Institute of New England, which resettles refugees in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And Jeff, how would you answer that question that I asked Wendy? What do refugee families need the most?
You know, they need what I think they get from the city of Manchester, and that is a warm welcome. They need neighbors. They need friends. They want their kids to settle into the schools and become good students. What refugees really want to do in our experiences is just belong to a community. You have to understand, they've been displaced from the Congo. They've gone to, you know, another country. In Jackson's case, they've lived outside of the United States for 15 years. They've had tragedies, terrible tragedies. They just want to live in peace. They want to contribute, and they really are looking towards the future at all times. They want their kids to be successful, and they want to be welcome. They want their kids to play sports. They want their kids to get involved in school like every other kid. They want to, you know, join the country and be part of the United States, and that's what they want.
Well, and earlier in response to a caller, Jeff, you said that the U.S. should increase the amount of refugees it brings in. In years past, as you know, sometimes the city of Manchester's pushed back and said, we don't want to be unwelcoming, but hold on, State Department, we've got all we can handle. So right now, if the State Department suddenly decided, okay, Jeff Thielman, we'll go with what you say, does Manchester have the capacity to welcome more people?
I would love for the State Department to say, okay, Jeff Thielman, we'll do what you say. But yes, I do. I think Manchester does have the capacity, because there's different ways to evaluate capacity. So one thing is are there enough jobs? The answer is yes. And in fact, we get calls from employers every single day saying, do you have workers? Do you have workers? Not just in Manchester, but all over the state. So the first thing, the first test is there enough employment? The answer is yes. The second thing is, you know, are there enough social service agencies that can welcome and support people? And, you know, we have, yes. I mean, the answer is yes. There's lots of good services. There's a good relationship we have with the Manchester Public Schools. There's a limit. We're never going to have 1,000 refugees coming into Manchester a year. The most we had in the state was a few years ago, we had about 500 or so in the whole state. So we're not talking about dramatic increases, but I think there's enough jobs right now. There's a school system that is very much ready for kids of different backgrounds and different language skills, led by Wendy and the whole team there. And so I think it's a city, yes, that can take more refugees. And we also, the other thing is, we don't just place refugees in Manchester, we place them in Nashua as well. So we sort of share the burden a little bit. And the other organization places refugees in Concord.
Wendy, what about that? Is the Manchester School District ready, capable of absorbing more refugees? We do hear stories about the school district that classes are too big. You guys in Manchester, pardon me, seem to have a new superintendent every year or two. I mean, there does seem to be some unsettlement in the Manchester School District. And I wonder what you think about the capacity question.
Right. I mean, I think that changing leadership always presents a challenge. But I do think, as Jeff said, we are uniquely positioned to receive more refugee and immigrant families because we have the systems in place. We have, 60 teachers who hold the special credential to work with English learners. We have a team of bilingual liaisons that link really well with Jeff's team at the International Institute. So they understand how to offer that warm welcome to our new families. And we have a school board, despite some criticism, that really does understand the needs of our refugee and immigrant students. And, despite that criticism, they've offered, on average, at least 2 new positions every year in the last 5 years I've been there to support the growing number of English learners in the school district.
How long have you been there, Wendy?
For 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I do think also the teachers have developed a curriculum that's really responsive to the changing needs of our refugee population. As we discussed right before the break, you know, some of our students come in with significant gaps. If they've spent years in a refugee camp and may not have had access to formal education. And we've developed a way to screen those students and really put them on a fast track, not only to gain English proficiency, but also to keep them on track for academic achievement.
Let's take some more calls. And I want to remind you, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. And to Dunbarton, where Bill is on the line. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, folks. I just had a question on how the State Department for refugees, an aspect I think of is the climate, for instance. I find it curious that a lot of sub-Saharan African refugees are settled here in the Northeast. And then I worked with in Afghanistan for about 4 years, and a lot of the interpreters I worked with were from Kabul, and which is a separate climate, and a lot of those that I know have settled in southern Texas, Southern California, and Virginia. So I'm just wondering what the methodology is.
Well, and it's a good question, Bill. Thank you. And Jeff, I'll throw that to you, because Jackson talked earlier about, you know, he's from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He gets off the plane, and it's fall in New Hampshire, and it only gets colder. So, you know, how does the State Department make those decisions?
So first and foremost, there's an attempt to reunify people based on a tie. So if there's a tie to someone in the U.S., so if there's a family tie or a relationship or a friendship, and so around the country, there's been, you know, often people are often placed because of that reason. But I will say, I think that the country last year that sent the most refugees to the United States was Congo, was the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so, and you know, Somalia has sent many refugees, Sudan. So it's basically based on numbers abroad.
Do you have a large, medium-sized community, Amu, in Manchester or in New Hampshire, of people who, if they're not directly from South Sudan, at least they sort of understand you, and people you can feel close to? How separate do you feel? I guess that's what I'm asking.
How separate do I feel, like, from someone besides South Sudanese community?
Yes, yeah.
I blend in with my neighbor. It's cool. Where does my kid go for sport, churches, all those places. Sometimes you may not get anybody to welcome you, but there's more people give you that kind of feeling, you're more than welcome to be around here. There was one time I actually experienced something I never thought was happen. I went to Market Basket just to grab some groceries, and I forgot something, so the cashier, I said, like, can I turn around to grab a bag of flour? She's like, sure. So I turn around, there was no one behind me. And when I come back, somebody in line.
Sure, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
I always forget something, and I'm always butting back in line saying, excuse me.
So I check out. Whoever was behind me was not happy. I don't know why. I left. He followed me till next to my car, and he just like, you guys are ruining America. Why do you come here and this and this? I'm just like shocked, like, I don't even know how to respond to this. What did I done wrong? So he throws some word at me, and he just right in my face. I don't know where to go. I have my youngest one in the car. I just freeze, like, stand there. And there was a lady, actually, American lady. She's just watching. She's kind of like pulling out her phone, maybe to call 911. The guy just talk, and like, thank you for ruining our country. And he left. And I was cheeky. But those doesn't happen 24/7. So there's maybe a chance you will find somebody actually rejecting you, but there's more people are welcoming you with the big heart beside of your community. So, like, in the city of Manchester, yes, I blend in with my neighbor. It's not just Sudanese, like all others, Africans, anyone beside just American. Like, so, yeah.
Well, and from what I understand, you've been emerged as a leader in the refugee community in Manchester, helping other people like Jackson, who just got here. Well, how do you see your role now, Amu, given that you've been here for 15 years and you've experienced a lot?
My role, I always, wherever I go, if I find someone doesn't know what to do or how to get help, it doesn't matter if am I going to understand you or not. I just approach myself, how can I help? Even though I don't understand, but well, what are you trying to do? But use your hand, like, describe something with your hand. And if I get it what you're saying. I will help you or I'll go get help. There was a one time I went to welfare and there was a lady from Somalia. She want to call the taxi to take her home, but she doesn't know how to ask. She doesn't have a phone. So I figured out, like, how can I help her? Like, so she's kind of, like, coming close to me because she think I may understand what she's saying. So I approach her also. I come close to her, and she's used her sign, like, showing me the phone, and she want to go home. So I figured out, like, I think she need a ride.
You can do a lot with sign language.
Yeah, I try my best. So I went and asked, like, hey, there's a phone she can use. She want to call some ride. They show me how to do it, and I did call. And actually, the number was a person who know her, even though he doesn't speak Somalian. So it's like, oh, yeah, I know. What are you talking about? I'll be right there in 5 minutes. So wherever I go, wherever am I, in the city of Manchester, or in Concord, Nashua, anywhere, even without a state of New Hampshire, anyone need help, I feel them. I've been there. And I'm still needing help. So I'm willing to help anytime. Sometimes I do some, I will give anybody a ride. If I see you need a ride, like, especially all the people. Sometimes they have a hard time to get translate. Like, they want to go to doctor appointment. They're not getting that kind of help.
Right. At the doctor, you yes. really want someone there.
Yeah. Sometimes I go for free. Understands. I don't get paid. So, but I feel them. I've been there. So, hey, right. if I can help you, I'm willing to do it.
Jackson, what kind of help have you gotten from other people in the refugee community like Amu? What sorts of connections have you made with people who have been in your situation before?
Really, yeah. When I came in here, I asked my caseworker who welcomed me. I said, oh, this is a new country. How am I going to get used of it? And she said, no, don't worry. If you got a job, you'll get friends and friends. Really, that was true. When I started working at Cintas as a truck loader, I found there the guy is called Kevin, who was born here, and all the parents are here, and another guy who is Jim. So those are my best friends at all, who get, like, in weekends when I'm at home, they just call me, hey, Jackson, where are you? I'm home. Doing what? Just watching TV. Hey, come, let's have a ride, let's move, let's drive somewhere. So you find, like, they're showing me their friends, I'm getting friends, like, taking me to new places, like, playing soccer, football, because my hobby is volleyball. They took me up to Jeffrey, playing volleyball.
To Jeffrey?
Yeah, even playing pool. I know if you know pool table.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, those are the two guys that are getting me to get used of the state, New Hampshire. Actually, I like them because they show everything new to me. Like even using an elevator, I didn't know how to use it. But they say, let's go somewhere. We're going to show you something new. Yeah.
That's you got it. A job really quickly.
Yeah. In 3 months, when I got here, I just started working.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Candy's calling from New Boston. Hi, Candy. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I'd love to give a shout out to Wendy and to two of her teachers at West High School. My friend Maddie and I have had the privilege of doing a volunteer gardening program with the two teachers and their EL students. And it is just, I can't describe how, it's just a privilege. These children, the way they have learned our language, the desire to communicate, the desire to be here and be a part of things is so powerful. But the teachers are marvelous.
Well, Candy, thank you very much for calling in. And so there you go, Wendy. I don't know if you want to jump in or not.
I would love to give a shout out to all the EL teachers in Manchester. I think they do a really nice job letting the students' cultural identities be a part of the classroom and really let that enrich the school community. And I think a couple of those programs we have with gardening, because so many of our students come from agricultural histories, I think it's been very therapeutic for them to, you know, maintain a school garden. It's a give back to their school, but it's also a nice connection to their roots as well.
How do you measure success, Wendy? Wendy, in your work?
So we talk,
you're working with a lot of kids.
Right. I mean, we have the standards measures of success that we're required to report under the state accountability plan, and that's both for the academics of English learners, which now under the new state plan, every school has to really disaggregate that subgroup. So you can look on the state's new iPlatform, which is a data website meant to keep this information transparent, and see how English learners are doing at every school. So the academics is one piece, and then also annually we are required to test them under federal law on English proficiency. So how are they developing along that
continuum?
So
the state and federal government have sort of boxes you have to check and data points you have to meet.
They do, and along with that comes some funding to also offer supplemental support to English learners. So in Manchester, we receive what's called Title III funding, and that can provide any supplemental support to instructional programming or for professional development for teachers or to support programs for parent engagement. And so we receive about $325,000 annually.
Beyond all the sort of, again, boxes you're supposed to check, you know, for the state or federal government.
Right.
How about you, Wendy, just personally? What makes you at the end of a year, a school year, go, okay, this was good?
Yeah, I think the last piece of that is really how are they doing culturally, navigating the two worlds? How are the health of our communities? I think in Manchester, we often boast that we're the most culturally and linguistically diverse school community. But when you walk into those buildings, do you really feel that? Do you feel that the cultural identity of those students is present there? And is educational equity really, it remains a focus for us. And I think we continue to work on progress in that direction.
Okay. All of you, we could have talked a lot longer. It was really nice to meet everyone. Jeff, thank you very much for coming, and I appreciate it. That's Jeff Thielman. Again, he's president and CEO of the International Institute of New Hampshire. Amu Deng, very nice to meet you. Thank you for your time.
It's nice to meet you, too. And thank you for NPR for having us here. At least the state can know more, or if we can learn more from you guys. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And Jackson, also, welcome to New Hampshire. Welcome to the U.S. It was really good to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Wendy, it was good to talk to you, too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.